The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Stephen English of Stellar Asset Management, one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. That's news to me.
No, definitely not news to me. Now that sort of like inflation starting to moderate and to, in fact, cool quite rapidly, and the markets are sort of baking in some pretty deep interest rate cuts for the rest of 2024, what's your sort of outlook for equities for the rest of the year, particularly in your sort of sweet spot of small caps?
I'll know more in a year's time. But you've got to suspect we've probably bottomed now, probably seen the bottom. I think the worst thing that us small and mid-cap, and I'm going to use that awful acronym, SMID, throughout this, Paul, but worst thing we've had to contend with was ZIRP, zero interest rate policy. It created all sorts of headwinds for us. You've had large cap supremacy, PE able to gear up and pay valuations our mid caps just wouldn't or couldn't. You've had consolidation of the wealth managers where size begets size and then they can only buy big stuff. You've had regulatory pressure where they think size is a proxy for risk when it absolutely isn't. And you've had pension funds who should, given the permanent capital nature or very long-term nature anyway, they should have been the natural buyer for small caps, but their fetish with volatility seen that a returns focus almost eliminated. So that caused more and more bond buying. Then the yields fell lower and lower, which caused the deficits to go up and up, which sucked capital into unproductive pension funds when it could have been put into much better use. So the rant over there. Hopefully we're through the worst. We've had the inflation shock, which caused the higher rates, which rates going up. It's more about direction of travel than the absolute number for SMID. But it is kryptonite for this mid cap arena. So now we've had that kind of visibility that they've topped perhaps. And more recently, you've had return-free risk, which you call the bonds, what you got down to 0% yields. You have return-free risk, but now they've actually gone to risk-free return again. For a while, that has crowded out investment. It's sucked a lot of capital away from small caps. Remember Tina, there is no alternative. Oh, poor Tina's missing, presumed dead now, because there is an alternative when it comes to 5% on a US treasury not so long ago. But I think, long story short, for us as small and mid-cap investors, I think our fortunes, weirdly, is going to be dictated in the near term by the performance of the Magnificent Seven. What they do from here, I think, is critical. There's been so much capital that has been allocated to just those seven stocks. I mean, it's incongruous. You've got Apple valued at the same size as the entire UK equity market. Mm-hmm. Now, one or both of those valuations is wrong, probably both of them. But if you see any sort of underperformance in that Magnificent Seven, and I think they've got it all to do to live up to the valuations, and you've got increasingly aggressive competition authorities against them as well. But any sort of wobble there, I think then you're starting to look at a reallocation of capital into our arena. Though I have been saying it for a while, I think this is a golden decade for SMID, but it has been feeling like waiting for Godot. There's lots of talk that London's broken. I think there's definitely remedial fixes needed from a technical and regulatory point of view, but it's not a UK disease. Everyone's fighting over the same issues. I think most important is where interest rates eventually settle. I've been hoping for interest rates to go up since 2015. I've been baffled at this life support that we've been on, or the economy's been on. And I think as small and mid-cap investors, if we can hold interest rates of 3% or above in the next downturn, I think we're going to normalize the playing field against us in the large caps and also against private equity. And I think that's key. And last thing I'd say on it, I think there's maybe overstated parallels to the 70s, but there's definitely some echoes to the 70s. If you look back at the two best single performing assets and asset type classes, it was value and small and mid cap. And the worst performing asset classes in the 70s, by order, it was growth as a style, government bonds and large caps was the worst. You didn't want to be in large cap full stop in the 70s. So if you get any sort of resemblance to that, then we should be doing a lot better this decade than certainly the last decade. Been thin gruel.
And what about this sort of like the M&A splurge in SMIDs, particularly in the small cap with AIM? I mean, it seems to be such that, you know, every single day we're looking at an announcement that somebody's getting sort of taken out by either private equity or a US trade buyer. Is that an indication that we've got significantly undervalued SMID companies on the UK, and also that the splurge is sort of like the timing is that, you know, a lot of buyers are thinking that actually 2024 could be good, and therefore let's fill your boots now.
100%, Paul. I'm reading all the Christmas. Apparently, the lawyers are getting all revved up. There's going to be another bonanza in Q1 from a takeover point of view. And there's a really good note last week by Peel Hunt. Charles Hall looked at the deals last year. There was 40 deals over 100 mil gone through. Interestingly, not one of them was FTSE 100. There was three FTSE 250 stocks. So 37 of those 40 were small caps. And that's kind of pretty telling where the value actually is. It does, though, cause this relentless de-equitization. But that can't carry on indefinitely. You know, reducto ad absurdum, if it does carry on indefinitely, we're all going to be left with one stock that's pretty big and pretty crap. So we might have a portfolio of Vodafone.
Or Apple.
Maybe.
What about one thing which hasn't turned up, surprisingly, particularly after the sort of mini banking crisis, is a recession. And we've been sort of in the UK bumping along that, but sort of technically avoided it. The US has powered through it because it's had so much sort of fiscal sort of like support, etc. Will we get that this year, do you think? And if we do, does it matter? Because the valuations have already built it in.
Yeah, well, you've hit the nail on the point. I think more the latter. Certainly, you'd be more comfortable as a UK investor than you would a US investor if you're going into a downturn. Typically small and mid caps outperform in the four quarters in and around the end of a recession. So the two quarters preceding it and the two quarters out of it, historically since the 80s anyway, they outperformed the large and mid cap stocks. And hand on heart, I did think we'd see some sort of recession. But what's kept the ship going, it's been the services side of the economy. Construction and manufacturing, there've been rolling recessions going on there. But services, because it's such a big component of GDP, has kept the ship going. I think it's those COVID savings have been much more bountiful than a lot of economists actually thought. I do think the rubber will hit the road at some point on that. Some people are looking in the US, the consumer is going to be pretty skint mid-year. I think it'll be very, very interesting how the economy can hold up then. And also the lag effect, the Python's been digesting this monetary policy pig for quite some time, and you reckon the lags now are more elongated than they ever have been. So it's just not a normal cycle. COVID has caused all sorts of weirdness. So the fact that we've avoided one last year, I think it'd be dangerous to extrapolate that to mean that we've avoided one full stop.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I actually think that a lot of the sort of like the consumer or the services spending over the last 18 months has been revenge spending, as people have gone on holidays, have gone cruise shipping and have gone down the pub and enjoyed themselves. And what we'll probably see is a normalization of demand. And that, so we will see a technical decrease in demand, but it won't go to be a downturn as we would normally call it, with mass unemployment where you see everybody laid off. So you'll just get a normalization from your revenge spending as we all went out and enjoyed ourselves. Okay, well let's move on to some sort of the stock picks you've got to run through. We've got, let's look at sort of the animal care side. Well, let's start with animal care, in fact, who do sort of like products for the veterinary area, and they've got some of their in-house products and also some third party as well. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it seems to be pretty cheap, trading at around about 13 times for a quite IPR heavy sort of like, you know, animal healthcare company.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was always a lovely little business, and then they did that reverse takeover of Ecufarm and just kind of queered the pitch a little bit on that one, because it's one of the worst deals I've ever seen. And then the share price fell 75%. But we've had a really good CEO come in from the human pharma side, senior roles at Astra and Glaxo. Jenny Winter. She's been there 5 years now, I think. It'd be nice if she owned more than 7,000 shares in the company. She do chastise her about that fairly regularly. But nonetheless, there's some of the more excitable commentators have described this as a mini Dekra. We're miles away from that at the moment, but Dekra in 2000 had the same market cap as Animal Care does today. And then it took them 16 years to get to a billion market cap. And then fast forward to today, and Dekra's a 4 billion market cap plus company. So even if we're a quarter as successful as that, you're looking at a big, big, big potential upside on this one. It's in nice areas. It's 70% companion animal. You've got the humanization trend that everyone's banging on about there. And you've got, more importantly, there'll be a lagged benefit as these COVID cohort of pets age, and as they age, obviously they're going to require more treatment. 20% is production animal, which is quite low growth, but it is a bit of a cash cow for them. And the rest is equine, which is only 3% of the animal care market, but it's overlooked by a lot of the big players. And I think there's opportunities there, maybe on M&A side on equine. Why do we like the animal pharma space? Well, you don't see the same patent cliff issues as you do in the human medicine. You don't get sales collapsing 80% overnight. Just doesn't happen. And it's also much quicker and cheaper to bring drugs through the pipeline. Obviously, there's less safety concerns than humans. And it makes the ROIs very, very attractive then for this IP that you've identified that they're increasingly targeting. They've trimmed things up. They've cut a lot of the marginal drugs. They had far too many. They've focused on their top 40 now, which has been to the betterment of the gross margins. And some of them, in terms of that pipeline, are later stage, but they are coming through inexorably. 3-4 years' time, we could be looking at one that's potentially very, very exciting, taking antibodies from llamas to treat canine arthritis. That's causing a lot of excitement. It's already making a splash in human medicine. If you want the jargon, Paul, repeat after me. It's small single chain fragments of the variable domain of heavy chain only antibodies, or VHH, we call okay. it
I'll
for
take
short.
Your word for it that time.
But it's holds a lot of promise, this one. They're already involved in the arthritic space for canines with Daxocox, and that's doing pretty well. So hopefully three, four years' time, it's a bit of a lottery payoff type thing, but if it does come through, it could be very, very lucrative. You know, the share price got to £4 during that COVID nonsense. It's now much, much more reasonable value. There's strong support at 150 as well. I think some people have been spooked at that normalization of sales. It did hit a high watermark and it's been normalizing since. So it's not going backwards per se. I think it's just normalizing, and you're going to start to see the top line moving ahead soon. And it also identified as a bit of a Trojan horse in this business, the old chipping business, Identicare, which they...
Chips for the pet. Identify where to locate pets.
Or pet reunification, as they call it, which I think is a lovely euphemism. You'd probably charge more calling it that.
Wasn't there a website called Friends Reunited? Just Reunited now.
Yeah, get on to that one, yeah.
So, okay, good.
This was kind of just trucking along, but now the new CEO's come in, change the leadership team. It's 3 million run rate. It's a very SaaS type business. There's good, better, best pricing. You know, you can take the middle menu and they'll send alerts when your pet goes missing to wardens and vets, like an APB, all pets bulletin. they can have that one for free as well. But they're going to try and scale this. Maybe you get this to 10 mil and you can do things like selling insurance into your captive database, get this 10 mil SaaS business over 80% plus gross margin, you know, stick a multiple on that. It does look non-core. You could be looking at 3x sales for that one and reinvest into the core. And on that, when I caught up with them recently, the team there, the most excited I've seen from an M&A point of view. I think Jenny said herself, we need to be braver when it comes to it. And this space in particular is all about scale. To get that share of voice with the vets, you need to have a certain amount of heft, and they may be a little bit subscale at the moment, but I think the hopper's quite full, and I actually think shareholders would support even a pretty decently priced or sized acquisition in the tens of millions of pounds. I think we need to take that step now. So it's always been a nice business. You know, there's connotations, good and bad, for that one. But I think we could be on the cusp of going into a much more dynamic period now.
Good. Yeah, I know. I think Christopher Mills from Harwood likes it and would probably be very supportive if they had an M&A strategy on the back of it. So, yeah, definitely a really sensible one to have a look at. Let's move now to CVS, which is another darling in the veterinary space, actually operates vet practices, but got kicked where it hurt just before Christmas by the Competitions Authority, who said that said they were doing an investigation into whether the industry was price gouging and there was any transparency in prices for animal drugs and stuff like that. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it has actually recovered a bit of that lost ground, because it got really taken to the woodshed when that announcement was released.
Yeah, thankfully not put down permanently. But I mean, I bought this April last year, and then a few months later the CMA review happened, and I'm extolling the verdict. And oh, thank you. I mean, it is, why do we like the space? It's structural growth. There's £4 billion in the UK alone spent on vets and other pet services, and if you pulled up the long-term chart on that growth, it just goes up every year. So it is underpinned by that high pet ownership in the UK. Pets are living longer, treatments are more complex, more expensive. And again, that humanization trend, there was some data point where apparently a quarter of owners spent £80 or more on their pets last Valentine's Day. Well, we're not here to judge, Paul.
That's like my wife, actually. We've got two cats, and she spends a shed load more on her on her feline friends than on me, that's for sure. In fact, nothing on me, which is great.
No, I don't take it personally. I mean, I've still got three photos of my dog, Rex, who died, sadly, 15 years ago in my office study. So I do get it, absolutely. Yeah. So it is resilient in downturns. Vet practices are local oligopolies. Which I love. I mean, I love monopolies and oligopolies. We used to hold breeding. That was another of that ilk, local monopolies. That's kind of legalized. And the UK market now is 55% corporatized. Mm. And I think the feeling was we get to 75, 80% until it's settled. And that's what the CMA are looking at. We think it's overdone. Share price is down 25%. If you read the Market Wizards book, something that came through in them is the market is very, very poor at pricing in a known unknown. It nearly always overreacts to the downside. You know, you don't want to hold it for fear of looking like a fool because this was very knowable. And I think there's been some incorrect parallels drawn with the CMA review when they looked at the funeral sector.
Yes.
You know, that one did.
Dignity, wasn't it? Was the exactly. one that got hit badly.
Yeah. I mean, So it's a lot easier to price, compare and contrast a funeral than it is pets. You know, you've got different species, require different treatment plans. Mm. But they were making 30% operating margins. This business making 20% operating margins. So I don't think there is that price gouging element at all. Hopefully we get a review that will be due soon and it won't move to the next stage of an investigation where it's just more like a sunlight. So more transparency. Does the pet owner know this is a big, ugly corporate that owns it? Did he have enough choice on prescriptions and that type of ilk? And what I would say is I do think there's some asymmetric valuation support built in here. I don't think the risk is that low. We know that the sector is consolidating. There's five major global players out there today, and CVS is the largest listed vet company now left. So there's real scarcity value. It's a sizable morsel for one of these guys. I think five will eventually become four. I don't think CVS will be listed, you know, 10 years time. And normally for that type of acquisition, you'd be paying 15, 16 times EV EBITDA. But given the overhang with the CMA, it's currently on around 10 times. Yeah. So they've got some very good aspirations. They've just moved into Australia. People thought they were a bit landlocked in the UK and running out of the road. They could still double in the UK, no problem at all. But by moving into Australia, where they're going to spend £50 million per annum on acquisitions, and they're also spending £50 million per annum organically, it's added a brand new growth leg to the story. Normally, that would have been additive to the multiple. So you may have been... you know, maybe 16, 17, 18 times if it was listed without this CMA. So I think this could snap back very, very quickly. They've hit the ground running very quickly in Australia. Culturally, very similar. They understand the market. The language, obviously, very similar as well. And there's only two other players in Australia, and it's much less corporatized. It's only 15% consolidated at the moment. So a long, long growth runway to go after. It's all about execution, but they've got some very, very well-laid plans, you know, to double the size of EBITDA, and they're well on the way to doing so. So it is a distraction, but hopefully not terminal at all. We think it's well overdone, the CMA risk.
When do you think that will actually happen, the make a decision on the CMA? Sometime, obviously.
They said early. Yeah, they said early this year. Okay. Yeah, so hopefully not terribly long now. And the other point I'd point out, there's different aspects of the CMA. They've got the market aspect, but they've done acquisitions after this review was announced, and they've been tacitly greenlit by the CMA, because whenever they do an acquisition now, they send documents to the CMA ahead of time to allow them to say no. So the fact that they don't say anything, that kind of is a tacit green light to do that. And they've done a number of them since this news broke. So this isn't looking at or calling into question the consolidation aspect and saying, that's it, you're done. It's more about pricing and choice and fairness and transparency.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's just move to the last one then. We've got Impario, who basically are a sort of manufacturer and distributor of animal feed in the UK, but largely sort of like natural animal feed. That's without the antibiotics all in there and the chemicals, etc. It came out with a pretty soft trading update, as I think farmers were struggling a bit in H2. What's your sort of outlook for this? The shares are pretty, actually, they're not that cheap, but that's presumably because of the trough earnings.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head again. Thought you're pretty good at this, aren't you? Hey, you've done this before.
Not as many times as you.
It's. I mean, it's been a perfect storm, really. You had COVID; they were just getting over that. You had African swine fever. You had bird flu. Then you had Ukraine, which pushed up all sorts of amino acid costs and fertilizer costs for the farmers. And we know the world of pain farmers have been in. Then the meat prices were falling; demand fell. And it's been better for the farmer simply to not produce animals, because every animal they were producing, they were making a loss on. So that really hurt the volumes, the demands for Impario. The interims weren't pretty recently. Revenue was down 7%, but volumes were down 26%, which is huge for this fixed asset business, where utilization of that factory is key to recovering your overheads. I think, though, if you look through that noise, their higher added value products were very positive. You know, OptoMega was up over 100%. Origo Stim, which uses Origo essential oil, was positive growth as well. And what they're plugged into is that natural feed is increasingly having to replace the use of antibiotics as growth promoters, which are increasingly banned. And also pretty nasty chemicals. You've got zinc oxide and formaldehyde still used in feeds to keep mold and bacteria at bay. Or they've got natural alternatives to them. So they've got really good products. I think we're just waiting here now for a lot of mean reversion to kick in, for costs to abate. I think they reached the limits of what they could charge for certain of their products, but they're starting to fall now precipitously, a number of inputs, certainly on the amino acids, energy, fertilizer, soft commodities as well. There's better supply and demand for the end farmers, their margins of recovery, which should drive that volume recovery too. And there's a global movement really to increase animal yields and welfare. So you're trying to produce more food with less inputs, particularly less land inputs, and also less carbon and methane. We know the industry's got a bad reputation on methane, but they've got a product actually which helps that too. So to be fair to them, they did a big tender offer. They reduced the shares in issue from 24 mil to 20 mil at 225p. They returned 9 mil. But they are, again, a bit like Animal Care, subscale, 30 mil revenue. Need to be bigger. They're one of the unluckiest or unwilling companies to have engaged in M&A over the last 5 years. They have been very disciplined on the prices in a sector that did get pretty ridiculous from PE and the prices they were paying for some pretty marginal businesses. So hopefully that's now coming their way. They are looking at M&A. They have been. Hopefully will land something next 12 to 18 months. And on that EBITDA point, yes, it doesn't look optically cheap on 12 times EBITDA. Their five-year average is normally 14 times. This is a high-quality company. Yeah. We're on recovered earnings. So sales are pretty similar to when they did EBITDA of 7 mil, but you're only looking at EBITDA about 3.8 mil yeah. because of that under-recovery of overhead on similar sales base. So on recovered earnings, you're looking at more like 6.5 times EV EBITDA. Okay. And I think that's the opportunity. You're getting a 4% dividend yield as well. Mm. I think the issue's short-term in nature. There's nothing fundamentally broken with the business. Forecasts will rise quickly if and when we do get that volume recovery. And it's a strong balance sheet as well. They're not distressed at all financially.
Yeah. Well, I must admit, I could be an easier customer there because I've got a problem with methane as well. So I might well be picking up some of their product. Now, let's move quickly on to the consumer. One of them you've picked is, a Fevertree, which is obviously an iconic sort of like a mixer cocktail drinks company, all gain, all natural, largely for tonic and for ginger beer and stuff like that. It's got its heartland in the UK, was an absolute darling, branching out to the US. Shares have surprisingly softened out just recently, and I'm guessing that's maybe something to do with a read across of what Diageo said before Christmas. And likewise, I think on Friday, we had Constellation Brands coming out with another sort of soft or profit warning, et cetera. So what's your sort of like the investment thesis on Fevertree?
Well, I'm desperate to copy Warren Buffett any time I can get. I'm still working my way through the snowball. It's
that's a tough read, actually.
Lengthy. I think I started it 4 years ago. he fell out with the author of that, you know. He never spoke to her again.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. After she wrote it. Yeah, interestingly enough. But like Buffett, I mean, he loves Coca-Cola. I mean, drinks companies, well, they're basically a recipe and a brand, and you get someone else to make it for you. So they're incredibly asset light, so very high rocky. I call Fevertree a Yogi Berra stock.
A Yogi Berra stuff.
Yeah,
you know. What's the link?
His aphorism when talking about a restaurant, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. Well, nobody buys Fevertree because it's too expensive. So it's kind of, which is an oxymoronic in its own right. But 65 times PE doesn't smack value. They got clobbered on glass. They're a premium brand, so they disproportionately package in glass.
Yeah.
So they reached the limits again. That price elasticity kicked in. They couldn't fully offset that, and then they were having to ship a lot of heavy glass product and cans over to America because they were trying to spin that up. But a lot of viewers may not realize now that the US is already the biggest country region for them. It's overtaken the UK. I think the UK is X growth, certainly from a volume point of view, and I wouldn't be buying Fevertree if I thought this if it was all about gin and tonic. I think that has proven to be a bit of a fad. This is more about the wider halo of Fevertree as a brand. So they're the number one ranked in America already for tonic and ginger beer. And they feel as costs normalize, and they've got a lot better at that. And sometimes the best thing you can do is have a heart attack in a business after it's all been too easy for you almost. You can get lazy, you can get a bit flabby, and this has now really focused them to really hone in on tendering things now, get the cost down, and I think now the operational gearing will kick in all the better for that. Can they get back to 30% EBITDA margin is the key question investors should be asking. I think they can. I don't think there's any reason why. I don't think they're structurally broken at
they're
all.
Currently on about 15.
15, EBITDA. Yes, they are indeed.
So and on half, 15, yeah, 15 compared to your 30.
And the market's pricing in that 15 to kind of be the way of it going forward. But the US spirits market is huge. You know, they've got products, the Pink Palomas going great guns. Sales were up 30% in the US last time. They've got products for vodka mixers and Aperol as well. spiced orange ginger beer is the fastest product launch they've ever done. They're moving into cocktail mixers as well. It is a founder-led business, which we like. And the easiest thing in the world for them would have been to dial down marketing in this downturn, but they didn't. They maintained marketing spend at about 10% of sales, and that's about 40 million quid a year. I mean, if you're an upstart trying to crack that, there's no way near that. That's an asset in its own right. And they didn't deplete that brand equity. So the brand equity is now sky high. As situations do recover, this should hopefully now be a genuine normal year for going out and holidays. And, you know, there's a lot of catch up last year, but I do think that'll kick on a pace as well. And they've got 90 million quid of cash sloshing around on the balance sheet. If there's anything that I've been disappointed with them is not to engage in share buybacks. I think it would be hugely accretive at these sorts of levels, particularly if you fast forward 3 years hence, as that American opportunity really does prove itself. And it does have strategic attractions. Periodically, you'll see rumors that they're dusting off the defense document from a takeover, you know, a bit like CVS Group. It's the only global mixer brand, premium or mainstream, with a single ownership, and it has become the partner of choice for global spirit brands. So I do think the downside is increasingly limited. That may sound odd on a PE of 65, but that's based on certain temporary costs that we think will abate, and scaling up that bottling plant in America is key to that as well. So we don't think there's any damage to the brand. We'll see what sort of half-lives these ancillary products have, a cola, lemonade, cocktail mixers and the like. But I think for the next 3-5 years, it does look very, very good, set fair from recovery. Not sure I'll be owning it in 10 years' time, but wouldn't want them to get picked off down here. A 50% premium to this share price would be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, as Yogi used to say, hey, boo boo.
Smarter than the average bear.
It is smarter than the average bear. Yeah. Now another one in the consumer space is Warpaint, which has done terrifically. That's the sort of challenger cosmetics brand. And what sort of like I've been following this sector and that particular share for some time, and I sort of like picked the wrong horse. I went for Revolution Beauty, which was a much bigger business, but as they're sort of like crossed, and now I think Warpaint's bigger than when Revolution was actually listed. So do you want to take us through Warpaint, because you've really chosen the right company to back there?
Yeah, I've been invested in them from previous shop as well, pretty much since IPO. So I've known the guy 7 years. So we had a big up, and then we had a big down, and then we're on the up again. Another founder-led business, own over 50% of the shares. Ian and Sam, it's the what caused the first warning, they over-indexed to independent high street retailers who were suffering badly. Before that, actually, I'll give you a story. This was sold to me at IPO as a pure organic growth story. Then they rang me up and said, we're going to buy something called Retra, which brought in the Technic brand. So a few expletives later on the phone to them and said, look, for such a left field announcement, you only do this if your core growth is slowing. No. And then about a year later, we had a massive great clunking profit warning. But we laugh about it now. But to be fair to them, they pivoted the strategy after that, and they've targeted now the big grocers and the supermarket chains, both in the UK, Europe, and the US. You know, this thing, you could have bought it almost just for the cash and the value of its inventory at one point. Michael Burry of The Big Short fame got involved. He was on the register for a while.
Oh,
he saw the deep value in it. I think he's
followed you in on that one, Stephen.
He must have, yeah. I think management would have loved to have taken it private when it got to such low levels, if they could have got the financing for it. But they haven't looked back. So Tesco, they started in a small number of stores. Now they're in pretty much every Tesco store. I was in St. Helens Tesco on Saturday. Every time I'm there, I just tidy up the little W7 stand. But you're starting to see they're getting more and more shelf space there as well. Boots, Superdrug, they're extending it with Boots already, another 100-odd stores. So it's a classic land and expand model. They're unashamed of dupers, so they smell what's selling. So internally, the prestige brands, and they'll copy it, get it back on the shelves with their pretty fancy packaging, 3 to 6 months. So they really plug into that and they target the younger end of the market. So it's a layering on of revenues. Every retailer they get into, they start small and then invariably they get rolled out across that retail estate. So I think the numbers looking forward, even on the ones they've announced currently, I think there's so much latent pull through as they extend that rollout. I think you're pretty underpinned there. So any new retailers that are going to get announced on top of that is going to be all grist to the mill and accretive from there. We've had 4 upgrades last year. I don't think we're done there yet. I think we're still early innings on this one. The US is a vast, vast market. It's 10 times bigger than the UK. And if we do a bit of navel gazing here, in 5 years, I don't think it's beyond the realms to be seeing this business doing 300 to 500 mil revenue. Mm. You're looking at 60 to 100 mil EBITDA from 20 mil EBITDA in FY24. So that sounds fanciful. You pick the midpoint, 80 mil. We're on 15 times EBITDA at the moment. Yeah. Assume a big derating down to 10 times even at 80 mil. You're looking at 800 mil enterprise value from, 300 mil today. And the UK, why is that perhaps not as ludicrous as it sounds? Well, the UK is doing about 30 mil of sales at the moment, and there's still a long way to go after. But if that's representative of the whole, and the US is 10 times bigger than UK, well, they could be doing 300 mil in the US alone. And I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if you see these guys eventually try and move into the prestige side as well. So L'Oreal's been very good at this, running a bit of a barbell approach. I think that will be accretive to the earnings as well. I don't think it's anything immediate. And you rest assured they won't overpay, and I won't swear at them. If and when
this time
they do that, yeah. But Revolution Beauty, commiserations, Paul. That was touted hard by the broker at me. I had a look at it.
Yeah.
Thing never generated any free cash flow at all, and they were obsessed with EBITDA for a pretty capital-intensive business. All the furniture they were spending, and you can put lipstick, foundation, Botox on a pig. Well, that pig was never going to win any rosettes at the farmer show.
It didn't, unfortunately. They've got plenty of work to do on that one. But I would highlight Warpaint to investors. I mean, it's trading at about 22 times PE, but it's growing its top line at 30% per annum, like for like. So if you run it on a peg ratio, it's less than one. And I think that's sort of the key sort of valuation tool on a fast-growing GARP stock with a big addressable market. So,
We may switch at some point into Revolution Beauty. There's a real good business there.
Well, I'd hope so. Now, another one. Let's move sectors to medical devices. Inspiration Healthcare, another one which has been through the mill over the last 2 years. It's run by Neil Campbell, I think, who's the CEO, the long-term one. Then they came out with an interesting announcement. They basically do ICU neonatal sort of units to help babies get through premature birth, etc. Things like warmers and breathers and ventilations and stuff like that. It's about 2/3 of their business, and I think they're trying to get their lead product approved out in the States. And they did a very interesting acquisition of a distributor in Florida at the back end of last week, which gives them that beachhead to get the distribution. What's your sort of latest view on this one? Because if you believe the numbers for this year, or effectively for the year ending January 25, so the next year or century, they're actually trading at sort of 7.5 times PE with a pretty decent balance sheet. What's your sort of look on this one?
Yeah, probably knowing better than me, Paul. It's scratching my head on this one, because you look at the share price and it looks like absolute disaster. And or financial distress or it's imperiled somehow, and it absolutely isn't. They've had some hiccups. I think guidance could have been better, should have been better to the market.
Yeah.
The CFO has been replaced there, and you've got a guy who's come in with some pedigree there from ex-Sinclair Pharma. Pretty impressed with him. I think he's going to be a good foil for Neil. Neil's a very passionate CEO, and he's not short of ambition at all. And you're right, that acquisition, very, very interesting. I think it's very clever. It's very easy to go into the US, could have been overpay for something, or try and go it alone through very expensive hires. So this is a kind of off-the-shelf distribution sorted for them in advance of that ventilator. I think it's the SLE 6000, which is really a best-in-class ventilator in this sector. It's micro factions of gases and oxygen in tiny lungs. Really very clever and a renowned piece of technology. And the US, again, it is a vast market. It's, I think it was Investec who were talking, sorry, Liberum, were noting some similarities to Advanced Medical Solutions on this one. Mm. In the early 2000s, just when they were starting to use their cash flow and infrastructure to build a bigger business and improve the quality of the earnings, well, they went on to nine bag in the 8 years after 2010. And I think you're at a similar stage with Inspiration Healthcare. You're going to much higher quality business than a 30 mil market cap would infer. The market itself, unfortunately, the incidence of premature births is increasing structurally, about 7% per annum. No government would ever want to pull funding for this care. It's one of the best ESG stocks alive. It literally saves babies' lives. And the product, even though they're a small company, they punch above the weight. I'm fortunate enough to have a second child late last year, Evie. And I was grilling a midwife because I saw an oxygen tap of some description. Inspiration's logo was on there. So I was just asking him, did he have the LifeStart trolley, which is a really nice piece of kit. If you want to resuscitate a baby, you can keep them close to the mother and you don't have to cut the cord prematurely because there's a lot of benefits from deferred cord clamping. And yeah, she couldn't speak highly enough of the product and the quality of it. I was asking her in between contractions, Paul. I'm not a total bastard.
I bet your wife loved you. Just doing a bit of due diligence on
exactly.
This one.
You never stop, do you?
Exactly. It's not important, this for the second child. It's just making sure the machine's okay.
Exactly. Well, you've got the US is 40% of the global market, whereas it's rounding error in terms of Inspiration's current sales there. You've also got a new chair coming in March. I think that's good from a timing point of view. Fresh pair of eyes, just kick the tires a little bit. This guy also comes with serious pedigree. He was CEO of Optus PLC.
Yes.
That was bought eventually by Nikon, about 260 million quid. Then he moved on to Gyrus, which is minimally invasive surgery. And again, that was sold to Olympus for just under $2 billion. And then he sat on the chair of Medica until that was acquired very recently as well. So very interesting. Very, very good at building smaller businesses to become something much, much bigger. Balance sheet's not an issue. Should be zero net debt by the end of the year. They're just coming on the back now, just completed a 2-year major investment program. So I think you'll see little incremental spend required now for future growth. And if you benchmark into peers, 0.9 times EV sales, it's just, to my mind, it's just the wrong price. You can, if you benchmark into peers, you can make, you can get to a pound plus from a share price point of view. So not a disaster at all. I think stage one is get the re-rating. Last update, we didn't have another warning, which is positive. They just need to get into a beat and raise series now in terms of every time they report to the market. And really nice to see the share price back above the 200-day moving average. That's the first time that's happened in 2 years, such has been the protracted nature of this bear market.
Yeah. No, I agree. It looks crazily priced for a small cap company with a big addressable market and some lots of good growth drivers. Now let's move to sort of industrial services. Let's start with Avintraz, which is basically it's a buy and build specialist engineer, and it's got sort of big franchises in nuclear and energy, and also in sort of blast. So it does basically blast proof doors for HS2, the tunneling, and it also does sort of like high integrity storage boxes for Sellafield that put sort of low level nuclear waste there for 500 years under the ground safely. But on top of that, so on top of the engineering. And also for sort of oil and gas, etc. It's got a specialist medical business, fledgling medical business with Medica and Adaptix, which does sort of, I think, sort of like MRI and X-rays for small form sort of vet practices, but also for orthopedics. What's your sort of your view on this one? Because it's going through a bit of an investment phase in the medical side, which is reducing effectively short-term the profits and also sucking a bit of cash into it. And it's all being funded by the sort of the, you know, the cash cow it has in its big, strong engineering franchise.
Yeah, it's everyone calls it the mini Melrose, don't they? But I think
That's right. Yeah,
I think you should be calling Melrose the big Avingtrans. I think they're better than Melrose. Right. The two Steves there are a class act. It's always interesting when you got three Steves on the call and we don't know who's talking to who.
One's a Glaswegian, one's a Liverpudlian. Well, one's certainly a Glaswegian anyway.
Yes, yeah, definitely. You know, normally you run a mile. If an incumbent is trying to buy a distressed asset and turn it around, the track record of doing so is lamentably low. But this is their raison d'etre, and they have built up so much money in the bank. They've done it so often, you just trust them to get on with it. I mean, nuclear, it was nasty until the EU now decided it's green. You know, it should have always been green. We need nuclear as a base load. The proliferation of green energy makes the grid much more variable. They're already making inroads on the small modular reactors. Terra, which Bill Gates... Terra Power. They're already supplying into them early doors and a number of other suppliers. And I mean, Rolls-Royce, they were bottom of the tree when it came to supplying Rolls-Royce, and now they're a top 10 supplier. And Rolls-Royce have been so impressed with them, they've actually dragged BAE Systems to the table and said, you need to work with these guys. Such is the quality of their engineering. So I'm a big supporter of British metal bashers. I think there's some world-class engineering talent in this country, and these guys are brilliant. They're exploiting that and really building businesses to achieve what they should do. So yes, Metalcraft, we've been waiting for this massive elephant, £900 million next contract. It keeps moving ever rightwards. Nuclear is just, you know, the delays already, it just keeps costing taxpayers more and more. That 900 will probably be a billion by the time that plus by the time they get their
That's the nuclear storage contract, which potentially is signed in the next 2 or 3 years.
They've moved into the next phase and no one else has joined them. So no one else can make these things. So the Sellafields want probably three suppliers. Avingtrans is going to have to teach them how to actually do it, or maybe license it. So they're going to wait until they get that before you look at a disposal of Metalcraft. Booth Industries, which they bought out of Redall administration for a song. That's the blast doors for HS2. They've also got a lot of doors on the tubes platforms as well. They've been very clever at putting aftermarket sales into that, which is essentially sending a guy or a girl with an oil can and oiling the hinges and charging pretty meaty price for it. That now has a record order book, 36 million. Mm-hmm. And when you're trying to increase or maximize the value of a business, it's all about the visibility. So the order book is an asset in its own right. And I think that's kind of oven ready now, if you were looking at maybe what's going to be the next sale. Because this strategy, pinpoint, invest, exit, you do need exits at some point. They don't hold these businesses in perpetuity. And nor did he want to squeeze every last drop of the lemon. They always like to leave something for the next man and woman. So, you know, they put £3.5 million into that in total from working cap and various other cash flow. I'd be disappointed if they get less than £20 million upon sale of that one. Ormandy is now at critical mass as well. You could be looking at a sale of that later on this year. And then the medical side, it's always been finger in the air. What are these two businesses worth? Adaptix, which is 3D x-rays, very, very portable. It makes sense to put them into the GP setting. And then you've got Magnetica, which is helium-free small MRIs. Kind of looks like a cement mixer. You can stick a limb in there. Yeah. It's that small. But GE, you've got 200-odd small MRIs, which they dabbled with, but that they're no longer supporting. So that's a really good nascent customer base, and are already getting inbound inquiries now on the back of that. So they could hit the ground running. We're just waiting FDA approval for Magnetica now, which we're hoping to get this year. They've signed that distributor, as you would have seen. And I think, may look like a mug here, all options open. They may merge Adaptix Magnetica. There's pros and cons to doing that. It may act as a poison pill to someone who wants a pure play X-ray versus an MRI player. They may IPO it. They may sell it. Million and one options for them. I think you could be looking at the market cap just on the medical side now. And I actually think energy is worth more than the market cap as well. Yeah. And they've got that Luton facility, which could be worth 10 mil as well. So don't look at this as a normal valuation or metrics because of that investment they're pouring into medical, which is going to be heavily loss-making this year and next, 6-7 mil of losses. It's more of a sum of the parts one on this one. So yeah, watch this space.
Yeah, I mean, with the track record of the management team, the share price has gone up sort of like 20% per annum over the last 15 years.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's certainly no sign of that slowing up, that's for sure, over the long term. Now, again, let's move to another one. We've got Franchise Brands, which has been on a buy and build sort of B2B franchise owner, largely in things like it built, I think it bought Filter, which does sort of like vegetable fat, sort of like, or effectively a cooking fat treatment. And it built another business in hydraulic hoses, just with Pirec and stuff like that. But it's all B2B, and it's franchisees. So, or should we say it owns the brand and the IPR and then franchises it out. The shares have been knocked a bit recently. Do you want to take us through this one? I think it's probably on the back of it's got a reasonably heavy debt load, I think, 76 million compared to an EBITDA of 38.
Spot on. Yeah. This is founded by Stephen Helmsley and Nigel Ray. So Nigel Ray, ex-Saracens fame.
He was in Avingtraz, actually, before Christopher Mills took him out.
Indeed. I mean, he's a shrewdie in his own right. Founded in 2008, got a 24% stake combined. There's a really good podcast in the company of Mavericks, which Steve was on. And if you want a bit of background to him and what he stands for and his values and his ability as an entrepreneur. So Stephen Helmsley, he was ex-Domino's.
Yeah.
He was CFO, then he became the CEO, then he became the chairman. I think under his CEO tenureship, Domino's was an 8 or 9 bagger, and it just carried on going up and up and up when he was chairman there. So this guy understands franchising. He understands how to make it work for the franchisee in particular. And the key thing he took away from Domino's was how much of an enabler tech and digitalization is. So anyone can cobble these businesses together, but to get the efficiencies for what is a van-based business, it's all about route density. So if you can do 4 jobs a day rather than 3 jobs a day, it's incredibly accretive, and it's the holy grail when it comes to reactive call outs. It's the holy grail of it, and they're working very, very hard, and they bought a key software for the franchise sector, which has helped them as well, which they're actually selling to other franchisors. So you've got the chief information officer is ex-Domino's. There's so many ex-Domino's alumni. You don't have to have worked for Domino's, but it certainly helps when it comes to franchise brands. And like a franchise business, I almost say, why wouldn't I own it rather than why should I own it? That's the first thing you should ask, because you're using other people's capital to grow. And that capital light obviously makes it very, very high return on capital employed and very, very cash generative. So mainly B2B. They do have a B2C side, which is chips away, car repair, oven clean, and barking mad kennels. But really, the star of the show was chips away. They were hoping that they could have sold B2C. One analyst thought it could be worth 25 million. It does about 2 to 3 mil EBITDA per year. Low growth, but highly cash generative. But the offers that they were getting just weren't sensible. So they're going to retain that for now. Then you're right, they bought Filter, which was a name listed company as well. I think Stephen would have preferred to do an all cash, but the Filter founders actually wanted to take paper in the enlarged entity, which augurs well. And in the US, fryer management, so they go into the stadium, and these stadiums could have 30, 40 deep fat fryers quite easily. They love deep fat over there. They go in there, very hot oil. They can do it when it's still hot, recycle it, cleanse it, and it doubles the life of the cooking oil, makes things taste better. But by doubling the life, it means it's less expensive. And there's little to no competition for what they're doing from a fryer management point of view in the US. The medium term, they're looking at targeting $500 million of invoiced sales in the US alone. And if you had a quiet word with Stephen, he'd admit to having ambitions for $1 billion of sales. These are system sales at the franchisee level, and then they clip their management service fee on the back of that. I mean, that is a business of real, real scale, potentially. And then Pirtek Europe, which was pretty unhappy when I got the news of that one. The price paid was pretty full, over 13 times. It was over 13 times EV, but then there was a 25% discount to the share price, which unsettled me again. And then for unholy trinity, it left net debt EBITDA
about two and a half times.
So yeah, a bit grumpy on that one, but don't let perfection be the enemy of progress and all that. And it is a really, really high quality business. They are the best at what they do in that sector. These are hose management, so industrial hoses, reactive, so they can be with a factory or a building site within 1 hour, and that's 24/7, 365 days a year. It's been private equity owned four times. They actually tried to buy it a few years ago, but got outbid by the vendor who sold it back to them now. Like private equity, they weren't keen on planting trees for others to take shade in the future years. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit to go after with a permanent owner now who's going to move into eight other countries that they're not yet operating in. Actually, Flowtec Fluid Power, which I'll come on to, it's one of their biggest customers, Pirtek Europe. It's a business of real, real scale. And I think they want to get to 500 mil market cap, which you do always wince if you have a market cap target. Mm-hmm. It's 300 odd million at the moment. That net debt is falling. I think it should be a much more comfortable one and a half times by the end of this year. And then I think you're going to see the rating go back up again. This business has total returned, even after this sell-off, you've done 20% total return per annum since it's IPO'd. 50% of its growth has been organic. 50% of it has been acquired. And 10 times for this quality of business, 10 times EV EBITDA, again, I keep saying it, the rating's just too cheap for the quality and the growth runway that is in front of it. One risk I would flag, there's some oil price risk, believe it or not, because they recycle and sell cooking oil as bio oil. So that has been causing some volatility. I've been at pains to them. I never want to see a profit warning on the back of a falling oil price. So as long as the expectations have been set sensibly, that shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. Well, if they can reduce the net debt, if it's a cash generative business, and they do that quickly, then it will re-rate. I think a lot of it's just a bit of skepticism it's just a bit toppy, that level of net debt to EBITDA. So I think that's probably
at this point in the cycle.
Yeah, the big number one challenge with interest rates. Okay, well let's look at Flowtec Fluid Power, as you briefly mentioned. It basically does is distributor of pneumatics and specialist hydraulic parts and services to industry in the UK. And it's been through a bit of a tough patch, I think, over the last 4 or 5 years. It's never really been able to sort of increase its gross margins and reduce its stock. What's your sort of view on this one? Because they've got this new CEO who comes very, well-respected, Mike England, I think, who's really looking for a turnaround. What's your latest on this one?
It's some shareholders may look at the register and you've got the great and the good there.
Yeah, I know.
Wondering what the hell are they doing on there? And you've got Roger McDowell in there as chair, who's a phenomenal operator in his own right, takes no prisoners. And then I've owned it 5 years and it's gone absolutely nowhere. And I've owned it 5 years too early. But what you got now is the business I thought I was getting all the way back then. You had Bryce, who was CFO, became CEO, a business that was supposed to be buy and build, but they never built what they bought. They never integrated it. Mm. Bryce said about trying to integrate that, but you see it so often, CFOs tend to have blind spots commercially. Mm. You need an entrepreneurial vision really to kick on. For a CFO, it's, to the man with only a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, to a CFO with a calculator, everything looks like a maths problem. But there's much more to it than that. So Mike England's come in from RS Group, which viewers may know as Electrical Components. Yeah. And he was the group COO of a £4 billion company. And now he's rocked up at Lowly Flowtech, which is always very, very interesting in its own right when they move down the leagues. I know the CFO now, Russell Cash, big fan of nominative determinism, Cash by name, Cash by nature. He's a, he's an old school bean counter, but he knows his onions. But he described it now as having many more Premier League type players. But it's interesting when you go from a big company to small company, you've got pretty, well, Champions League level colleagues, and then you won't have when you're coming down the level. So it doesn't always work, and it's actually easier to go up the level. So can Messi do it on a cold night away in Stoke is the question. Can Mr. England do it at Flowtech? I think he absolutely can. You're looking at the initiatives he's put in place already. He's a man of extreme energy and no shortage of talent. I was a bit upset that it was in worse shape than I was led to believe, but you know, sunlight is the best bleach. It's getting resolved now. He's brought in some really, really senior hires from those that he knows. And he's done this before, in particular on the digital side. And the digital side at Flowtech is key to unlocking everything else. So that gross margin, the inventory turn, getting a lot better and more granular data on stock turn at each individual stock level. The e-commerce piece, being able to online order from one website rather than a series of websites where it just looks like tinier business. You wouldn't even know it's owned by Flowtech previously. So they're moving to a one brand approach there. So you get more velocity, you get higher ROCE, you get higher free cash flow margin, you get stronger balance sheet on the back of that. And then that gives them optionality as well then to engage again on M&A. And UK sales are dominating it currently. They are looking at Europe, which is 15% of sales today. That's the natural next step for them. And there is a strategic imperative to consolidate this industry. Diploma have rolled its tanks on its lawns now through an acquisition of a Me Too type Flowtech business, who are very, very aggressive on the M&A side. So they do need to counter that. But no one is knocking it out the park in this industry from a fully joined up, high service level, digitally enabled distribution company of hoses, pneumatics. And he's also looking to move beyond that into what he calls the world of motion. So not just hoses, but you know, actuators, pumps, valves, the kind of mechanical circuit boards, they're kind of already in there at the moment, but they're going to do that a lot more than they are doing. Flow controls, that means that the total addressable market is three times bigger than their current one. And it should also future proof the business as we increasingly move into electrical driven mechanical machinery rather than oil powered and air powered. So take a step back. Like, you got 0.6 times EV sales.
Yeah.
I think if they can hit their mid teens operating margins, you could see 1.5 times EV sales. I was penciling actually 200 mil revenue within 5 years. Yeah, you put that on 1.5 times, you're looking at 300 mil enterprise value versus 70 mil today. But actually, Mike England's got much, much bigger long-term aspirations than that. He thinks this business is capable of doing 1 billion revenue over the long term. If you get your 15% operating margin, 150 mil EBITDA, it sounds fanciful. It would take dilution to get there. But the foundations are being put in place today for this to be a far, far bigger business. And that's why all of these shrewdies and I are very, very interested in this company today. Yeah. It is all about execution. I do think we've now finally got the right man at the helm to do that. And I would just point towards his options, which don't start to crystallize until the share price gets above £2 and they fully pay out on a share price above £3.
Good. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I've been watching it for a long, long time, and I know it's got a fantastic rock star shareholder register. So a lot of those initiatives are self-help, so they don't need a lot of goodwill outside the organization. It just needs just as you say, great execution. Okay, let's move to software. We've got Traxys, who are basically one of the world's best sort of like software and services providers to the rail industry that needs a huge amount of help in terms of digitization and improving, you know, safety and mission critical services and efficiencies and stuff like this. The shares had sort of like sold off from very expensive levels, and they've ticked up just recently. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it does look a bit of a jewel in the crown for UK technology.
Yeah, I think this is kind of buy and sleep safe at night stock. Yeah. And hopefully still own it in 10 years' time and it hasn't been taken over. It is a gem. Believe it or not, the UK does lead the world when it comes to rail. And
which is difficult to get your head around.
Ironic, isn't it, in the extreme? But from a safety point of view and the plumbing that's involved in it. So I think Traxys is like the ERP system for that industry. It works with everyone, really, from a stakeholder point of view. It was, again, another M&A construct that needed properly integrating. And you've had an exceptional management team come in there, Chris. He's done a great job, and they've also done a great job at simplifying the message, and they've really now broken it down into the two divisions, which has made it a lot cleaner. And actually, I think it's a real sign of genius if you can simplify a message. You know, it's easy to obfuscate and make a business complex, well, one as complex as that, just impenetrable to the outside investor. So if you look at the slide deck now to where it was 3-4 years ago, leaps and bounds ahead. So really pleased with that. It's a structural growth company. Look at the long-term chart. It was doing 10 mil of revenue in 2013. Now it's doing 82 mil of revenue. It's 30% CAGR, largely self-funded as well, which is another attribute of the model. And I think that will remain the way of it. And the CEO has come in and he's professionalized the group. He's integrated things and it's really made it match fit to kick on now to the next level. And despite government inaction and the strikes, we had recent organic growth coming in at 10%, which I thought was very, very good. And it's just plugged into a lot of these key trends that we're looking to get more from less from the rail network. The US is the key opportunity here. I think in 3 or 4 years' time, the US will be bigger than the UK. It did a tremendous acquisition of Railcom. It's gone so well, they've actually brought forward the rebrand of that to Traxys. It was under the previous owners, they were a little bit backwards in not being proactive enough at engaging with the customer base. And now the more and more they're talking to the customer base is just loving what they're selling and they can't get enough of it, particularly the remote condition monitoring, which monitors signals and the like. And it's all about preemptive maintenance. So scale of the US market, obviously vast. I think they've got 20 times more rail track than we do in the UK. But you're pushing on an open door there.
I mean, the amount of problems they've had with sort of track conditions and signaling problems out in the States, they've had huge explosions on rail freight and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Exactly.
Massive opportunity because they're so far and away behind the UK, in fact, anywhere, which is surprising for the US.
It is. And then you're looking at, there's more M&A to come on this one. They've got a traffic division, which is the odd man out. It does Glastonbury and the like, keep people safe, closes roads off. Their key competitor has just been acquired by private equity. Mm-hmm. They're desperately scrambling to try and find out what the value of that was. Yeah. This is a 28 mil business in Traxys, so even if they get 1x, which I think would be a fair enough price for that, you know, 28 million quid, reinvest that along with the net cash. That saying, I think sequencing wise, they're not going to get smaller to get bigger. I think they're going to get bigger and then maybe look to divest that traffic side. I think they're worried what it would do to the rating if they were to take a step back first. So looking in Europe, and they're looking very, very aggressively in the US as well. So watch this space on that one. But we're lucky to have such a world-class company on AIM.
I agree. Absolutely lovely business. Okay, well, let's move to Echo. And this one is just sort of like sort of call center, sort of like software and services, but particularly to help assistants when they take credit card details and therefore it masks the actual, I think it's the that three-figure number that people put in over there for their credit card details. And I think it's sort of like it wasn't a bit of a darling, but it's gone through a bit of a sort of like bit of a few problems just recently in terms of elongated sales cycles for the industry as companies and corporates have pushed back. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it's looking pretty cheap actually compared to where it was before.
Yeah, again, this is, I mean, a bit like Traxys. It's that higher quality. It's a category killer in its sector, world class small cap. But like so many small cap tech stocks, we have superb IP but can never scale it. Whereas the Yanks are superb at scaling it.
That's our American friends.
That's right. Now, hopefully, again, this doesn't get picked off too soon because they've got it all ahead of them. It's all about the US, this one. 90% of their sales efforts now are focused on the US market, which is huge. It's 20 times the size of the UK market. There's 39,000 contact centers in the US. It employs 5 million workers in its own right. And there's a lot of difficulty now if you're a manager of these contact centers post-COVID with work from home. It makes it very hard to monitor your operatives and also how productive they are, but it makes fraud. So this is what's known as card not present.
Yes.
So I always wince now when someone asks me what read out your digits and, oh, God, bloody hell. You know, they could just be writing this down. They got my name and address. They got the three digit on the back and I absolutely wince. So there's very, very strict regulation that's supposed to keep your data safe. But the majority of US contact centers are still using non-secure payment collection methods rather than Echo solution. Echo solution is very clever. It tokenizes it and keeps it outside of the call center. Yeah. So they don't need to get audited because it never enters it as far as their auditors are concerned. It never enters that, so that's fine. And Echo gives them their certificate to say everything's safe. So US has been in fits and starts. They made an acquisition. Actually, it's really helped their go-to-market. They were much cleverer making inroads into the US market. That said, though, they've got some tremendous Fortune 500 clients already. The blue chip roster, these are enterprise grade Echo. They're not really targeting the SME side of things at all. And then you've got, hopefully, we've been waiting for this one to catch a wave. You've got PCI, payment card industry regulation version 4.0 is coming out in April. If the page count is anything to go by, it's 360 pages versus 139 pages for version 3. You could start to see those that are trying to get around it at the moment failing their audit, which would then kill them from a risk and an insurance point of view. So that will focus the minds very, very quickly when it comes to the sales cycle. You can only fail an audit once, then you've got a certain amount of time to get your ship put in order. Otherwise, you get red flagged to Visa and MasterCard, who could potentially, worst case, delist you from taking payments over there. So this is serious, serious stuff. And we're hopeful that that will really get the top line going, because the one thing that's been missing, it's never been margins, it's never been cash flow. Earnings that have all been fine. The missing ingredient here has been sustained double-digit top-line growth.
Yeah, well, they need a good marketeer as the CEO to hopefully kickstart that one. Okay, well, let's move to sort of tech-enabled services. We've got Cortex Tech, which doesn't really get a lot of limelight, actually. It's a telematics business, and I guess people, obviously telematics 20 years ago was really, really sort of like, you know, well thought of, et cetera, but it's got a bit more of a crowded space. What's sort of like the USPs of this business, and what sort of like, you know, attracted you to it?
USPs of this one, it's just ridiculously high customer service. They got 4.9 out of 5 on Trustpilot. This is very much focused at SMEs, which is underserved.
Yeah.
Their average fleet customer would only have 10 vehicles.
Right.
So they're not targeting those with, well, they do some, but, you know, 500 plus vehicles. It's more smaller operators who value that contact center. They value the data they get from it. It helps reduce fuel 25%. So pays for itself. And you may think, oh, telematics, Christ, that must be mature as hell. But
yeah.
Actually, in Europe, you've got 50 million vehicles commercially, and only 25% of them are using telematics at the moment. The US is more mature. They've got 30 million vehicles, but even then, that's about 45% penetrated with telematics. So both markets are in structural growth still, kind of 10, 12%, which is a nice rising tide to start with. But unfortunately, they kind of lost away a bit recently. Andy Walters was the founder and CEO for a long, long time.
Yeah.
He's still a big, big shareholder.
He's just come back, hasn't he, I think?
Well, it's been a soap opera in terms of the drama at the boardroom. He owns 22% of the shares. He took his retirement. I think he bought a nice boat. He's not ostentatious. It wasn't a yacht. And then he was looking forward to a bit of a quieter life. And then he handpicked the CEO. They wanted the continuity candidate who wouldn't really change or upset the strategy, because they feel that the strategy, they've been doing very, very well. So why would you change it? And then that was okay. But then they made an acquisition for some software business based in Germany that helps you transition your fleet to electric vehicles. So it looks at how many miles you're doing, where's the charging points, which vehicles would you need, how much will it cost you, all of that good stuff. So they bought it and they paid £2.5 million for it, and then within 3 months they've written it all down. So I call this an Ali Deer acquisition. Probably the worst player ever in the Premier. He had 50 minutes as a substitute.
Just gonna say, I've never heard of Ali Deer.
Well, he was George. Some guy pretending to be George Weir was ringing around loads of football managers and saying, we've got this player and he's a real player. So Graham Souness fell for it. Got him in training on Friday and put him in this bench, put him on the bench at Southampton on Saturday. Letizia gets injured, comes on, and 55 minutes later, the guy can't play football and he gets hooked and he never to be seen again. So there are sometimes Ali Deer acquisitions, and you may think that's a weakness, but actually to admit defeat so soon rather than throw good money after bad, I think that's a superpower, and they'll be applauded for that. The CEO, though, I think has fallen on his sword because of this acquisition, and it was loss-making. They paid 20 times sales for it, and it's going to cost them £500,000, and basically there's no demand for it. Early adopters tried it, said it's all right, but they don't want to use it again. So that's upset things. They've got a £4 million cost now as France sunsets 2G, moves to 4G. They're going to replace the devices there at a cost of £4 million over the next 3 years. But again, whenever you go through issues, you always ask yourself, is this structurally broken or are these short-term issues that will get fixed? I actually think they will get fixed. We got that structural growth. Europe, I would prefer them to focus all their attention there. The UK isn't ex-growth at all. France are doing very, very well. That's their second biggest country. They've got 60,000 vehicles there. They've got 140,000 subscribers in the UK. And these businesses, the value is all about the number of subscribers they've got. Yeah. So 250,000 subscribers. And it comes back to this layering of revenue on top of each other. They've got a lovely chart that shows some customers have been with them 10 years plus. They've got a 1 year payback on any new customer. If you've been there 10 years, there's a 400% return on investment. So it's really, really lucrative to hang on to these clients. So you might not want to rush into this one necessarily. See what Andy does. On the one hand, maybe this thing has succession issues. They've tried it once, didn't work. Or does that mean that maybe it makes a sale eventually more likely than not and bringing that end game forward? Don't know.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move on now to another one, which actually has done really, is Oxford Metrics Group, which has sold a company. And then I think it was, I can't remember which business it was. But
Yotta.
Yotta, that's it. Yeah, got a big lot of cash, which is still on the balance sheet, actually, for future acquisitions. In fact, I think the cash balance is about 40% of the market cap. And they do specialist sort of like motion technology and software to be able to help film production, but also, you know, sort of like medicine and all different types of industries. Do you want to take us through this one? Because I think it looks optically at about 21 times PE, but when you exit the cash, you get really less than 12 and a half times PE.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I mean, talk about succession. Well, this one couldn't have gone any better. So you got Imogen Morehouse, who is a force of nature. She was the CEO of Vicon, which now is basically what Oxford Metrics solely is. She was the CEO there since 2012, so she knows this inside out. She's the only CEO I've met in 20 years who was sat on an ejector seat of a fighter plane. If you ever get to speak to her, it's a Vulcan seat. She loves the Vulcan from an engineer point of view because she is an engineer.
Yeah, okay.
And actually, as an aside, for these types of businesses that are very engineering heavy, the best person to have at the helm is an engineer who understands the pain points of their customers much more so than if you had some guy or girl who was just a brilliant salesperson in that organization and then became CEO. That ends up driving a wedge between that company's engineers and its customer, who are engineers as well. So fantastic, fantastic hire there. It is all about Vicon. They've got some very explicit growth plans over the next 5 years. They're well on the way to getting there. They've got that war chest, £65 million, and they've just started to make moves into that one. I actually think, and you see it so often, that the stock market doesn't value a pound at a pound. It values it at less, almost, although they're going to destroy some value there. Depending on how much to deploy and the valuation of the deals to do, you could be looking at 20 to 60% earnings upgrades on the back of that investment. They're not going to do anything silly. They want to grow their revenue from FY21 by 2.5 times from 28 mil to 70 mil.
Wow.
And they just did 44 mil of sales in FY23, which is largely Vicon. Do you think Vicon could be a 150 mil business in the long term? So there's still plenty of growth to go after there. But the ponds they were fishing in, they described it as a pond. The M&A potential was quite small, whereas now they've made a very astute acquisition in the smart manufacturing space. And that is now an ocean that they're fishing in from an M&A point of view. So it's cameras that looks at production lines and looks for defects. So it's quality control.
Yeah, okay.
Johnson & Johnson's a key customer of them. So it's contact lens manufacturing or paracetamol packaging. Very, very highly regulated. These things have to be perfect. You can't have any defects whatsoever. There's ramifications from that. And that's now a very, very interesting adjacency. And I think you may see ultimately there, it allows them to move away from the R&D side of their customers' operation to the shop floor. Yeah. And smart manufacturing is now becoming more and more of a thing. It's where you kind of working symbiotically with robots or smart benches, and you've got your glasses on with information on your glasses and put this piece here and put that piece there. But you've seen, well, we've seen last year, late reports of a robot that went a bit rogue in Tesla and injured an operative there. So you could easily see Vicon's technology monitoring the motion of the robot. And if it gets too close to the human operative, just killing it straight away so they avoid injury there. And it's opened up a whole new growth vector for them. The other key thing I would point to that we're so excited, certainly longer term, is location-based entertainment. This is where you put your goggles on. You know, you got Sandbox, Immersive Gaming, two of the biggest there. They love Vicon. There's no other motion measurement technology that can touch them from a capability point of view. And we don't know how big this thing could get. It's quite small at the moment. They only did 2.5 mil of revenue from location-based entertainment. But COVID really slowed the rollout of these game boxes. I would also draw a viewer's attention to one of Vicon's clients, Immersive Gaming, have signed a deal with Merlin to take technology. And they've got something like 800 different venues with eight game boxes per venue. So really, really big potential numbers. And what they're using is the latest innovation, which Imogen and the team have been working on for the last 3 years plus. So Vicon at the moment, you have to put markers on you. So, you know, like the green screen in the past or Hollywood uses. So you've got markers everywhere. You tell that dot, you tell the computer that that dot's the right shoulder. So it knows forevermore that that particular dot's the right shoulder. And it measured it very, very, very accurately. Now they've moved into something that's great for most, but they've just now spun up a new technology called markerless. So you don't need any markers at all. It's all about machine learning. It'll look at a person and it will deduce that's a right arm, that's a left arm, and it tracks you. It's not as accurate as marker, obviously, but it's good enough for a number of applications. In particular, their location-based entertainment company wanted something a bit less bells and whistles, and they've actually been designing it in collaboration with Vicon, and they've been holding off on their rollout until this technology has just dropped. So I'd encourage you to go on the website and have a look at that. They've got a video of the Markerless technology, what it's capable of. I don't think it'll cannibalize existing sales.
And that technology sounds perfect for theme parks. It'll take it to the next level of experience, no doubt about it. Being able to, interact not only on the rides or have bespoke rides at the theme park. So, I didn't realize that. Now, let's go to Gamma Communications, which does sort of call center software and services. I guess it makes 51% gross margins, and it's moved a bit into sort of managed services as well, with cybersecurity and stuff like that. I guess the question is growth. And I know everything's going digitization, but I imagine this is quite a competitive area in terms of sort of like, people trying to get into this space.
It is competitive. Yeah, the core product probably suffers, or it's so competitive, 1-3% deflation, but they've been very good at innovating new products and upselling and cross-selling. So they've been actually maintaining or improving their ARPU. Mm. And you may not know, I was taken aback when management told me, but more than 50% of businesses in the UK and 70% in Europe still use physical internal phone exchanges. So PBX is the jargon. Now everything's moving to cloud. Why would you have a copper line and do it over there? You can do it over the internet now. And Gamma is a key enabler of that. So there's still a long, long runway, even in the UK, but especially Europe. And a few years ago, they started to make moves into Europe, but the traction to date has been slower than expected. Mm. But last update we had from them, we saw 7% growth in Europe, which is the best we've had in quite a while. And I like the direction of travel more generally. The transitioning from traditionally more of a reseller to actually moving up the value chain with their own IP.
Yeah.
And they are one of the leading call enablers within Teams. So Teams, without Gamma's assistance or someone else, you can't make physical calls using a phone number. You know, you can dial up another Teams user, but increasingly enterprises are using it for inbound and outbound calls using phone numbers, and we do ourselves. So they're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in the UK of that. And some people thought Teams would be a threat to Gamma, when actually it's an opportunity. And the UK product that they've got for Teams fits perfectly into the European market as well, where their customers are pulling them into as well. So I actually think the growth is there. It's always a prodigious cash generator.
Yeah.
That hasn't changed. The growth may slow a little bit on macro in the short term, but it's 90% plus recurring revenue. If you're a business that needs e-commerce and communications generally, the last thing you ever switch off is that. So only in the deepest recession would you be cutting your existing spend on this. And you're looking at now, the share price looks horrendous compared to, if you overlaid an earnings graph over the share price, the earnings just keep going up, whereas the share price has fallen precipitously, and it's all about the derating. It got excited on 35 times PE.
Yeah.
Now you're on 15 times, which is really good value for such a high quality business. Yeah. It's total returned 500% since its IPO, 20% per annum. And I think that's about right. I think actually you get a bit more help on a re-rating. So maybe 5 years, 20-25% per annum total return with this type of stock. And if it doesn't re-rate itself, then given that prodigious 70 mil of free cash flow per year, 150 mil net cash on the balance sheet end of this year, I've actually been encouraging to do a share buyback. I thought I would have heard confirmation of that late last year. Mm. Others have been asking for that too. We may get our wish soon, hopefully, because I think that's a really good use of their cash there. But if it remains lowly valued, then if we don't buy it, someone else will, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Rock solid balance sheet, 50% gross margins. Mm-hmm. So if somebody bought it, there'd be lots and lots of synergies and costs they could take out, no doubt about it. Let's move to RedCentric, which is again a sort of like an IT, managed services provider. Bought SunGard's data centers a few years back, And that sort of really lifted their gross margins. And I think they've got strong recurring revenue streams. Do you want to take us through this one? Slightly smaller business, but it seems to have moved into sort of cloud hosting and sort of that type of managed service.
Yeah, so cloud provision, they're doing full wraparound service now. They've added to the breadth of their service offering. You can get cyber defense now as well, and penetration testing and hosting and managed services. It targets the upper quartile of SMEs and the lower quartile of enterprises in terms of their client. So the White Company would be a client and Channel 4. And it competes and wins by dint of its tech teams. They get involved in bids at very early stages and they design a bespoke roadmap for the clients. And it's that much broader and deeper scope that they can offer than their peers tends to see them win the tenders. And in this industry, you either consolidate or you get acquired. They tried to flog themselves a few years ago, but didn't, and then decided, right, we're going to go for it now. And you've got another strong management team, both CEO, CFO, coming and done a great job at tidying up what was a pretty spaghetti number of systems. It's now a very, very finely tuned platform. They did 5 acquisitions within the space of 12 to 18 months, which no other business in that sector could have countenanced doing so. It's 90% recurring revenue. There's conservative accounting. They've now filled out that product and service offering to offer a one-stop shop. And it's a largely fixed cost business. So revenues from here on in are going to be highly, highly accretive. It's really good to see recently organic growth came through so strongly. That has been missing, and because it is a mature business, it's actually very hard to grow organically. Mm. You tend to have very sticky customers and you only win them if you really foul up and they move on to someone else. And whereas now the one, but because they've got 6 or 7 different products now, they're starting to drive cross-sell a lot more, and that's really getting the top line moving. And I think that's going to be key to the rating on this one. The ROI on acquisitions that they've made recently, I've got it at 30 to 40% return on investment. The CEO is world-class at finding cost savings. And then when you think he's done, he finds more cost savings down the back of the couch as well. And he's also superb at operationally cobbling these things together into something very, very efficient. So energy's been a major headwind for them. Yeah. They've now got very good visibility on the upcoming fiscal year, which will start from April time. You're looking at a £10 million reduction in the costs. So actually, the near term looks a bit full on 30 times PE. But from 1st of April onwards, looking at fiscal FY25, that drops down to 14 times or under 7 times EBITDA. And you're going to see a step change this coming year now in the free cash flow. We're looking at £18 million free cash flow there as well. And I can't say any better than Andrew Darley, ThinkApp's or Cavendish analyst now. They've got a great tech team there, ThinkApp. This thing is stupidly cheap. Tell us what you really think, Andrew. But yeah, I can't disagree.
Well, certainly, I mean, I think, there's a lot of levers they can pull for sort of self-help on that cost with energy coming down, but also buying the data centers from SunGard. That means they don't need the third-party hosters either. So they can offer, an end-to-end service that can be particularly tailored and customized to the client and will be delivered essentially at a gross margin of 70%, which is what they make, because they haven't got to pay for somebody else. So yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, they were in a dreadful state, though, SunGard. I mean, to the extent what little ventilation or cooling they had from the fans, they were just full of tree and vegetation that had gone into it, so it wasn't working anyway. So these things, it's no more clever than essentially sticking little greenhouses over the servers. You don't want to cool the entire shed, because that's very, very expensive. You want to just cool the servers, so you compartmentalize them. So the ROI on these things, you're looking at a 12 to 18 month payback on the capex that they put through.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be employing you as their sales director then, Stephen, to sell their hosting.
Not SunGard, no.
No, exactly. Now, final one, distributor Kitwave, which basically does all things distributing to sort of small convenience stores and local shops, etc. Perishables and non-perishables, maybe ice creams or tobacco or whatever it is. But they're a bit like the sort of a mini Booker, bit a buy and build. And I think the founder CEO is set to retire in a couple of months' time. So what's your latest on this one?
Yeah, it's been a serial upgrader since it listed. I think EPS has gone up 100% since IPO, and the shares are up 70-odd%. So it's actually derated perversely. So it hasn't missed a beat until very recently. Everyone on the board was an accountant. And I think that really tells you what they're solving. They're doing thousands of things well every day. And you have to keep doing that every single day. That's what logistics is all about. They do 4,000 customer drops delivered wholesale. You know, they're so good that Booker actually uses them for some of their last mile delivery.
Wow.
It's not a peaks and trough business, wholesale. That means visibility strong. They've got 400 vans in-house. And he's got a 35-year plus heritage with leading brands. And they're really at the top table. You know, Unilever, Walkers. Unilever were so impressed with them, they brought them into Domino's Pizza to supply exclusively all the Tom and Jerry's ice cream to every Domino's outlet.
Yeah, Ben and Jerry's.
Okay. What did I say?
Tom and Jerry.
Thank you, O'Reilly.
You could be right, though.
That's baby brain, Paul. Baby brain. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, and they look dirt cheap, actually. 5% dividend yield and less than 9x PE. So they're not exactly ragingly expensive, are they?
Well, which is a conundrum. You're right to mention Booker and a baby Booker. For most of its, certainly the second half of its listed life, Booker was on a PE of over 20. Yeah. And eventually got taken out on 25x earnings by, Tesco. Yeah. And I think this just needs a bit more track record. It's an asset-like business. It's, believe it or not, even though it's 5% operating margin, which puts a lot of people off, it's the stability of that operating margin is very, very strong. Because of that visibility, they're just clipping coupons for every box that they move. They like inflation. They tend to make more absolute gross pound profit in an inflationary time, which can offset any OPEX inflation further down on the balance sheet. And there's so much growth runway. They've only got less than a 2% market share currently. They've done 12 deals since 2011. They've only done 3 since IPO. They typically only pay 4 to 7x EV, EBITDA. And it's a 25% rocky business. So this is a classic compounder. Yeah. You know, too many people look at things and call them a compounder when they're actually not. But this one genuinely is. Unfortunately, the founder, Paul Young, is set to retire. Maybe they'll sing "Come Back and Stay" to him.
That it depends is, on where he leaves his hat. Yeah, I mean, I would say it comes back to that point you made earlier on in terms of the networking effect. If you've got a number of, you know, you've got a van that can do multiple drops in a near-term area, it actually gives you a lot of competitive advantage and barriers to entry for anybody new because they can't get that level of location density.
Indeed. And they're also, if you look at where they're targeting their acquisition, it's going to be on the food services side rather than the retail and convenience side, which is kind of their core business. It's double the EBITDA margin in food services. Right. So like dropping it off to pubs, restaurants, schools, hospitals and the like, it's much more accretive to them. They're a really good buyer. They've got a great reputation. You know, sometimes you can get a buyer's discount from that. You know, people don't want to always sell to PE. Like Judges have built that track record and credibility as well and gives them access to deals. And very often they've known the business for 10, 20, 30 years. So it really de-risks it as well. So sometimes you're put off by M&A things that they're more of a financial construct, but actually 2 + 2 invariably equals 5, if not more, with these guys. And they're just starting to get the digital piece going now as well, which increases the average order value relative to dialing and ordering over the phone. It's also lower cost to service. And you can also do great things like recommending stuff at the basket. Have you thought about buying this? Or maybe offer a special discount today on that as well. And they sit on a treasure trove of data that is incredibly valuable. And they haven't really monetized that at the moment because there's a real blind spot in the retail and convenience sector. Certainly Kantar would love to get all of that data.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, again, you know, very good, attractive GARP stock there. So if people want to sort of invest in the Stellar asset funds there, Stephen, how best to do that?
Through an IFA, invariably. we're an AMIHT only provider at the moment, so we do get our inbounds through our friendly IFAs. But you can also then, if you come onto our website, if you want to just keep tabs on what I'm up to, I do a quarterly fact sheet, go through, you know, buy sells, but I also do most months a company spotlight. You know, a lot of these companies are business to business. I prefer business to business than business to consumer. You just don't have to spend the same amount of marketing to retain your clients or attract clients. So the LTV versus CAC is tremendous. So, but because they're B2B, you probably use the service and you don't know it. So I like to do company spotlights and really pull the curtain back on what people actually own. You know, it's fractional ownership of some world-class businesses.
Yeah.
You know, AIM is infamous for a reason, but if you sift that detritus long enough, you do find some gems, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, I mean, if you're a good stock picker and you select the right companies for the long term, then you'll do very, very well. And obviously, there's some good tax incentives in terms of owning AIM shares, whether that's inheritance tax planning or just not even paying stamp duty. So there's plenty on offer there. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Steve. And I was going to say that was a quick whiz through, but I enjoyed it so much.
I did warn you, didn't I?
I thought, no. I thought I'd just keep it going because it was absolutely brilliant. So really, thanks again for your insights and terrific comments. And look forward in touching base in about 6 months' time.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Good to see you.
Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.